The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, thank you for coming to the first event of 2012. We thought we'd begin the season with a bang, which is why we invited Shalom Auslander and Ben Marcus, two inventive young writers whose latest works take on the burdens of history and language in ways most of us could not have imagined before reading their words. Shalom Auslander's Hope a Tragedy and Marcus's The Flame Alphabet are both intense, brave, and apocalyptic books. They share a focus on the family, the protection and dissolution of that unit. And they are both daring, moving, and mordant. In Auslander's case, outrageously and hilariously so. In Marcus's, intricate, disorienting, yet familiar, particularly to those of you who may have children. We're pleased both writers could join us this evening. Our first reader is going to be Ben Marcus. Please welcome Ben.
Hi, thanks so much for coming. I would like to read from my novel, The Flame Alphabet, which came out today. It is about, thank you. It'll be out of print tomorrow. Nice little evening I'm going to have and celebrating. I'll grieve and mourn tomorrow. The book is about a toxic language that comes first from children and makes people sick. The narrator has to flee his family and try to invent a new language that might be usable without sickening people. So it's really the story of the lengths a father will go to try to keep his family together, and also what happens to one's sense of morality when no one's keeping track of you anymore and when you can't communicate at all. I'd like to read just a short couple of sections from early in the book. And at this point, the narrator, Sam, and his wife, Claire, are sick, and they're not really sure why. And their daughter goes away for a while for a class trip. She's a teenager. And they start to feel better. And it dawns on them that they feel better because she's not there. And when she comes back, they're just massively sick again. In the months before our departure, most of what sickened us came from our sweet daughter's mouth. Some of it she said, and some of it she whispered, and some of it she shouted. She scribbled and wrote it and then read it aloud. She found it in books and in the mail, and she made it up in her head. It was soaked into the cursive script she perfected at school. Letters ballooning with heart-dotted eyes, vowels defaced into animal drawings. Each piece of the alphabet that she wrote looked like a fat molecule engorged on air, ready to burst. How so very dear. The sickness washed over us when we saw it, when we heard it, when we thought of it later. We feasted on the putrid material because our daughter made it. We gorged on it, and inside us it steamed, rotted, turned rank. Esther sang as she walked through the house. Her voice was toneless from the throat in a frequency high in wording power. A voice with a significant half-life, a noxious mineral content, that is, if it could be frozen and crystallized, something then beyond our means or imagination. If her voice could have been made into a smoke, we would have known. If you heard it, you were thoroughly repelled. She muttered in her sleep and awake. She spoke to us and to others, into the phone, out the window, into a bag. It didn't matter. Nice things, mean things, dumb things, just a teenager's chatter, like a tour guide to nothing, stalking us from room to room. Blame and self-congratulation and a constant narration of this, that, and the other thing in low-functioning, if common, rhetorical modes, in occasions of speech designed not particularly to communicate, but to alter the domestic acoustics, because she seemed to go dull if she wasn't speaking or reading or serving somehow as a great filter of words. She did it without thinking, and she did it to herself, and it was we alone who were sickened. But of course, we'd find out it was others, too. Others and others and others. What she said was bitter, and we sipped at it and sipped at it, her mother and I, just ever so politely sipped at it until we were sick, because this was the going air inside our house, our daughter talking and singing and shouting and writing. Whatever we thought we wanted, to hug or kiss our daughter, to sit near her, it was our bodies that recoiled first. We cowered and leaned away from her words. We kept our distance. But Esther was a gap closer, bringing it all right up to our faces. Some sort of magnet was in effect, a father magnet, a mother magnet. As we fled, Esther gave chase. We covered our ears, and she talked louder. Our daughter seemed not to care who was listening, and we were ready at hand, ready to service her needs. We stood up to it and took it like parents, because doesn't the famous phrase say, "Shit on me, oh my children, and I will never fail to love you"? The sickness rode in on my name, loaded and weaponized. Samuel, which Esther was old enough, her mother and I thought, to call me. A little grace note of parenting which seemed to work for other people and which we proudly took up as though we had invented it. But Esther wasn't impressed by this privilege. She barked my name until it became an insult, said it louder, softer, coughed it up, and spat it at me. We had missed the warnings on this one, phrases transmitted to our synagogue, the rabbi's droning cautions. And they were killed with their own names from the Psalms. Beware your name, for it is the first venom, Revelations. These warnings had always seemed like metaphors, the wishful equations of some ancient person's mind. Little comfort in the end, and it wasn't my name alone that was toxic, but all of them. It came in hello and goodbye and any little thing she said, except Esther didn't much say hello. When she didn't use my name, she said hey and daddy. She said chow and okie dokie on her way out, language she shared with some of the gender-neutral underlings incapable of eye contact she prowled around with. And with fingers I dragged my mouth to smile, even though it fell slack again when I dropped my hand. The reasoning, when reasoning seemed possible, was simple. Better to stand up to those happy moments, if that's what they were, and give Esther a father who wasn't such a spoiler, who didn't turn pale on the occasion of even the most basic speech. But my face leaked force each time. A daughter was someone to pretend to be healthy for. A daughter shouldn't see such sickness. Your child will be the end of you, Rabbi Burke had not yet said. I could speak back to her, and I could hear. Technically, I could. I could ask about school or the feuds that consumed her, the massive injustices, often by omission, perpetrated by her friends. But the words felt foreign, like they were built of wood, a punishment to my mouth just to extract them, like pulling bones from my head. That this poison flowed from Jewish children alone, at least at first, we had no reason to think. That suffering would find us in ever more novel ways, we had probably always suspected. I'm going to skip a little ahead, and things have gotten much, much worse. By early December, we huddled at home, speechless. If we spoke, it was through faces gripped in early rigor mortis. Our neighborhood had gone blank, killed down by winter. It was too cold even for the remaining children to do much hunting. I don't know how else to refer to their work. But sometimes they swarmed the block, flooding houses with speech until the adults were repulsed to the woods. You'd see a neighbor with a rifle, and you'd hear that rifle go off. The trees stood bloodless, barely holding on in the wind. We sat against the window and waited, spying out at the children when they roved through. The children, they should have been called something else. barking toxic vocals through megaphones as they held hands in the street. I hope they wouldn't turn and see us in the window, come to the door. I hope they wouldn't walk up the lawn and push their megaphones against the glass. And always, I hope not to see our Esther in these crowds. But too often there she was in the pack, one of the tallest, bouncing in the winter nighttime fog, breathing into her hands to keep warm. She'd finally found a group of kids to run off with. If there was an escape to engineer, we failed to do so, even while some neighbors loaded cars, smuggling from town when they'd had enough. The quarantine hadn't been declared, but in our area, they weren't letting children through checkpoints except by bus. Basic containment. If you wanted to leave, you left alone. Even so, bulky rugs were thrust into trunks, items that required two people to carry, usually wrapped in cloth, sometimes squirming of their own accord, a child's foot poking out. A clumsy game of hide and seek, children sprawled out in cargo carriers, children disguised as something else, so parents could spend a few more minutes with what ailed them. Claire retired as my test subject. She stopped appearing in the kitchen for night treatments, declined the new smoke. When I served infused milk, she fastened her mouth shut. If she accepted medicine from me, she did so unwittingly, asleep, whimpering when the needle went in. I couldn't blame her falling away like that, embracing the shroud of illness, but I did. I conducted nightly campaigns of blame and accusation, silently, in the monstrous internal speech that is only half sounded out, a kind of cave speech one reserves for private airing. In these broadsides, Claire spun on a low podium and absorbed every accusation. If I prepared a bowl of steamed grain and left it on the table for her, salted as she liked it, pooling in the black syrup, she passed her spoon through it, held up a specimen for study, and could not, just never could, finally slide it in her mouth. For Claire, I cut cubes of meatloaf, and at best she tucked one or two in her mouth where she could suck on them until they shriveled to husks. Claire no longer slept in her bed, and she seemed too listless even to maneuver to the crafts room, to the guest room, to anywhere she might be able to fall unconscious in private. I was always trying to offer her shield, a modesty curtain, so she could come undone, alone and unseen. She shouldn't have to collapse in hallways. If necessary, I helped her along, at least to a corner where I could erect a temporary blind. Once I found her asleep in the bathroom, one eye stuck open, leaking a speckled fluid. I crouched down and closed the eye, blotted it with my shirt. It opened again, and she whispered at me, "Hi there." I looked down at her, and she blinked, perfectly alert. Claire must have thought she was smiling, but that was so far from a smile. With my fingers, I tried to change the feeling, to reshape her mouth. I couldn't have her looking at me like that. Her lips were cold, and they would not stay where I arranged them. Her face had the weight of clay. "Go back to sleep," was all I could think to say, and I draped a bath towel over her, leaving her to rest on the cold tiles. At home, I took charge of what remained of our dwindling domestic project, the blending of food into shakes, the cleaning of all of our gray traces. I formed a packing plan, a strategy with regard to the luggage, mapped a route to outskirt lodging. Our pajamas, robes, towels, dish rags, these I washed every day, closing myself in the laundry room where the hot engine of the machine drowned out noise and thought. Against the hum of the washer, I was for a little while nobody much, and this was how I preferred it. I left Esther's warm folded clothes in her bedroom. Often they went untouched. Or later, after Esther had plowed through the house before returning to her gang, I'd find the pile toppled onto the floor, a heap of black crumbs like someone's ashes dumped over it. Claire's robe went mostly unwashed because she didn't like to take it off, and if I ever found her half asleep and staring into nowhere from her resting place, she wouldn't respond when I asked if I could do any laundry for her. She'd just smack her lips to indicate thirst. It'd be nice to have fresh clothes, right? I could clean these and have them right back to you. I tugged at her robe and she pulled away from me, threw an arm over her face. Your robe will be nice and warm out of the dryer. We could get you covered in extra blankets in the meantime. It'll be nice to be clean. You'll feel better. I spoke to Claire as if she understood me, but she only stared. I spoke to her through a stiff, heavy face that seemed fitted on my head solely to block me from speaking. I sounded like a man underwater. As our tolerance departed for the speech of children, so too did our ability to speak. To keep Claire hydrated, I'd have to peel back her hospital mask, prop her upright, and press the sippy cup straw through the gluey seal of her lips. I lowered the mask when she was done, and flowery welts of orange juice soaked through the fabric. When it was time to clean her, I filled a bowl with warm water, settled it over a towel at her bedside. With a washcloth, I soaped her neck and face. She lifted her chin, gathered her hair out of the way. I squeezed little pools of water over her throat. I placed another towel under her feet, then lifted and washed each leg, rubbing as softly as I could, watching the little streaks of redness follow my cloth. Claire's legs rose too easily in my hands as though they'd been relieved of their bones. With the last of the water, I reached into Claire's robe and washed her stomach, the skin that once held her breasts. I peeled her from the bed so I could wash her back, pushing the washcloth under the robe, feeling each hollow between her ribs, a sponginess I did not want to explore. Then I settled her back down again, pulled up her covers, lifted the mask from her mouth so I could replace it with a clean one. She forced a smile, but a shadow had spread under her gums, a darkness inside her mouth. When I brought her soup, warmed the long bread she loved, or offered Claire some of the candies that usually she could never refuse, baby amber globes with a cube of salted caramel inside, at most she would roll over, heave, pull the quilt above her head. It was only when the front door swung open and Esther came in the house, sweating, crazed, in clothing I'd never seen, that Claire sat up, drawing on some last reserve of power. She always wanted to catch sight of Esther, to watch her from a doorway. So she followed her from room to room, keeping her distance, and Esther tolerated the stalking. You could see in her whole body the effort she made to endure this attention she loathed. Esther had changed. Her face was older, harder, filthy from her outings, but spectacularly beautiful. Of course I must think this. I'm her father. Fathers do not easily succumb to assessments of ugliness where their children are concerned. Esther had never been a cute child, but she'd grown threateningly stunning in the last few months. She let her mother watch from a safe perimeter, and she was considerate enough not to turn on her with speech, to stop and speak until Claire fell. Esther saw her mother in doorways, looked away, said nothing. It was her greatest kindness to us, that silence. I will always appreciate the restraint she showed in those last days. Thank you.
Hello. So I'm going to read from a couple of different sections of the book because I'm in love with myself. The story of Hope a Tragedy involves a man named Solomon Kugel who takes his wife and small daughter and unfortunately his mother, who's supposed to be dying but isn't quite dying, up to a town that's famous for nothing happening, desperate to start over and get away from the past. And make a nice life for him and his family. The book opens with him lying in bed and listening to sounds that he hears coming from the attic, a tapping noise. and he's concerned that it might be an arsonist who's been known to be going around town burning down farmhouses, but what he finds turns out to be significantly worse. So I'll read from where he gets up into the attic. He decides to go upstairs. He sees a bunch of electric cords snaked around behind a pile of boxes and decides to investigate. Kugel went to the wall of boxes and from the top center stack pulled away a cardboard box labeled Jonah Clothes Winter and another beneath it marked photos Mother 1 of 6. He leaned over and looked behind the wall and suddenly felt as if the blood had drained from his body, as if it had run out through holes bored through the soles of his feet. His whole body felt leaden, stiff, nailed into place. He wanted to scream but found that he couldn't breathe. At last he forced himself backward, falling to the floor as he did. He fumbled for his flashlight, scrambled to his feet, and stepped cautiously toward the wall. Hands shaking, heart pounding, he aimed the beam of light into the darkness behind. No, he hadn't imagined it. He hoped he had, but he hadn't. There, on the floor behind the boxes, lay the huddled, blanket-wrapped body of an elderly woman. He tapped the flashlight against the rafter overhead, trying to rouse her. "Hey," he whispered. Nothing. He stood on his toes, leaned farther over the wall. She stank like decay, like death. Was she dead? "Hey," he said. Was she dead? Who was she? Was she the arsonist? Was she dead? How was he going to get a dead body out of here without Jonah knowing? Keeping the light on her with one hand, Kugel pulled down another couple of boxes from the wall with the other. And though the boxes dropped heavily to the attic floor, she didn't stir. She was on her side, curled in a fetal position on top of a small mound of worn quilts and tattered blankets. Her face was buried in her arms, but Kugel could see her sparse, unkempt silver hair, the blue fallen veins of her lower arms, the gnarled bones of her withered skeletal hands. The more boxes Kugel cleared away from the wall, the worse the woman's stench became, and Kugel had to fight the urge to turn his head. The smell seemed to engulf him, to pass right through him, foul and putrid, and he gagged. He covered his nose and mouth with his free hand, but the thought of breathing her in, of drawing her within him, caused him to gag again. He stepped back, swinging the beam of light around the attic, hoping to find a quilt or a tarp. Perhaps he could wrap her body in it and drag it down the stairs without waking up Jonah. Perhaps it would reduce the smell. And then what, genius? Leave her in your car? You're going to leave a dead body in your car? He had no idea how much time had passed since he'd first left his bed. An hour? More? He returned to the wall, leaning over even farther this time, his heart pounding so furiously that he wondered if Bree could hear it downstairs. A bead of sweat ran down his forehead, another streaked down his neck as he stretched out his arm toward the old woman and reached out with his flashlight. Slowly, slowly, until at last, with its end, he nudged her shoulder. He nudged her again. Dead. She was dead. Okay, that was better than alive. Or maybe it was worse. He reached out one more time, but just as he did, that ancient bony hand, as if rising unbidden from the grave, swatted angrily at the end of the flashlight. "Jesus Christ," Kugel hissed, darting back from the boxes and raising the flashlight overhead as if to strike. "Jesus fucking Christ." The old woman coughed, a sickly, terrible cough, and pulled the tattered blanket over her exposed shoulder. "Close," she muttered. Her voice was raspy and dry, and she coughed again as she pushed herself up onto her hip. "You're alive," said Kugel. She wiped the spittle from her lips. "I won't tell if you won't," she replied. "Who are you?" Kugel asked, aiming the light at her face. "What do you want? Are you the arsonist? How long have you been here? Do you need help? Should I call an ambulance? Are you the arsonist? Are you okay? Who are you?" She coughed again and cleared her throat. "I'm Anne Frank," she grumbled. "She's mad," thought Kugel. "She's alive, yes, I suppose that's a relief. Alive is better than dead. It must be better than dead. And yet she's very obviously mad. Should I run? Should I lock the attic door? How can I lock the attic door? I could get a long 2x4. I could jam it underneath between the hallway floor and the attic door. Yes, so she couldn't open it, so she couldn't get out. Well, who says she wants to get out? Where am I going to get a 2x4? The barn? The cellar? I should have a 2x4. A man should have a 2x4 in the house. He should. A man should. A man would." She turned her back to him, shielding her eyes from the light and shuffling farther back into the dark eaves. But before she disappeared, he could see that she was hideous, horribly disfigured, and terribly old. Kugel thought he'd never seen anyone so old. The white of her right eye yellowed with age, the left eye clouded with cataracts, dead, unseeing. Her skin, sallow and gray, was thin, almost transparent. The hair on her head, what there was of it, was sparse in some places, bare in others. Her shoulders hunched up around her ears, and a massive hump on her back forced her skull forward so that she faced the ground, head bowed, even when looking straight ahead. "What are you doing here?" Kugel whispered, his terror beginning to give way to anger. "What do you want?" "I want you," she croaked, "to turn off that goddamn light." "Who are you?" he quickly replied, pointing the flashlight at her. "How did you get in here?" She scurried farther back into the eaves, holding up a hand, trying to get away from the harsh beam of light. "I told you," she growled. "I'm Anne Frank. Now turn off that goddamn light." Fear is not an end state. It is a precursor, a catalyst. It becomes something. Occasionally submission, more often violence or rage. Kugel yanked another box from the wall and threw it to the floor with a crash. Then another box followed, and another after that. "Who are you?" he asked, his voice rising as he tore down the wall of boxes, forgetting Bree and Jonah and Mother downstairs. "What are you doing here? Who let you in? How did you get into my house?" By the time he finished, half a dozen boxes lay strewn about, upended. Their contents spilled across the floor. Kugel, breathing heavily, flashed the light at her again. "Who are you?" he demanded. He wanted to see fear. He wanted to watch her cower. Instead, with an insouciant air of annoyance and bother, the old woman pulled her cardigan around herself with one hand and fixed her hair with the other. "Oh," she said with a derisive sigh, "how I do adore meeting the homeowners." Kugel took another box down from the wall. Old textbooks spilled out, postcards, a badge of some childhood honor. Four more boxes followed the first to the floor, and when it was over, Kugel had revealed, behind the remaining boxes and to the left of her bed, what seemed like a small table. A two-foot-long scrap of splintered floorboard lay across a pair of Bree's old shoeboxes, on top of which sat a small lamp, a laptop computer, and a small laser printer. He aimed the flashlight at the makeshift office. "What the hell?" he said softly, reaching out to the pile of neatly stacked papers sitting face down beside the printer. The old lady moved very quickly, though, much more quickly than he would have guessed, and shouted, "No!" as she slammed down her hand on top of the papers. Kugel reared back. "You can read it," she growled, "when I'm done." Kugel looked at her, trying to decide if she was real or if this was something else, a dream, a nightmare, maybe a hallucination. He hadn't slept in a while. The stench, though, convinced him it was real. "I'm calling the police," he said. He snapped off his flashlight and backed toward the stairs, afraid to turn away from her. She waved in annoyance again, shuffled forward out of the eaves, settled in front of the computer, and, as if nothing at all out of the ordinary had happened, began to type. That was the sound, the tapping of the keyboard. He'd been hearing it for days. Kugel stopped at the head of the attic stairs. "And let me tell you something else," he said. She continued to type, paying him no attention. "I don't know who you are," he said, "or how you got up here, but I'll tell you what I do know. I know Anne Frank died in Auschwitz, and I know that she died along with many others, some of whom were my relatives. And I know that making light of that, by claiming to be Anne Frank, not only is not funny and abhorrent, but it also insults the memory of millions of victims of Nazi brutality." The old woman stopped typing and turned to him, fixing that hideous yellow eye upon his. "It was Bergen-Belsen, jackass," she said. Kugel continued to glare at her, even as he felt a flush of shame color his face. He turned and began climbing down the stairs. "And as for the relatives you lost in the Holocaust," she continued. Kugel stopped and looked at her, and when he did, she yanked up her shirt sleeve, revealing the fading blue-black concentration camp numbers tattooed on the inside of her pale forearm. "Blow me," said Anne Frank. Onward. "You expect certain things when you move to the country. You just do. You expect these things because you've seen the films, you've watched the TV episodes. You expect dishonest carpenters and creepy locals. You expect deer eating your petunias and raccoons toppling your garbage. You expect poison ivy and power outages and colorful neighbors and mice. You don't expect arson, and you sure as hell don't expect Anne Frank." Kugel sat on the edge of his bed, staring down at the telephone in his hand. Behind him, Bree snored softly in her blissful, oblivious slumber. The numbers on her arm, they were a problem. A big fucking problem. If she didn't have numbers on her arm, he would have phoned the police immediately. But she had numbers, didn't she? He had seen them, those damned numbers. And the numbers meant that Anne Frank or not, consumed by madness or not, half dead or not, rotting like a 100-year-old corpse or not, the old woman was a goddamn Holocaust survivor. Was he really going to throw an elderly, half-mad Holocaust survivor out of his house? Speak of madness. He could never do it. He knew that, even if she was old and emotionally damaged enough to think she was Anne Frank. Pity was a funny thing. It would be easier to throw out the real Anne Frank than it would be to throw out a Holocaust survivor so fucked up by the Holocaust that she thought she was Anne Frank. Can you imagine the headlines? Can you imagine the outrage? Local man evicts Anne Frank. Jew drops dime on Holocaust survivor. Brutalized by Nazis, tossed out by a Jew. One survivor's tragic story of something. If he'd heard the story, he would join in the outcry himself. If you were watching TV one night and the news came on and they reported with all their practiced shock and disgust that a man had thrown an elderly, broken Holocaust survivor out of his home, would he not share in the outrage? And wouldn't he be right to do so? The story gets weirder, the smiley anchorwoman would say. The homeowner was a Jew. Boy, oh boy, the smiling anchorman would add, now I've heard everything. Now I have heard everything. This was a hell of a way to start anew. He'd never received any love from his mother. It would have been nice to be accepted, even if only for a while, by a community. But what could he do? Let this crazy old woman live in his attic? It was absurd. For how long? A week? A month? A year? Until whatever Holocaust she thought she was hiding from came to whatever end she thought it would come to? Until she dropped dead? And what if she really was Anne Frank? It wasn't impossible. They'd found former Nazi officers in Rio, hadn't they? Ex-camp commandants in New Jersey? Went out a famous survivor in Stockton. Could he take that chance? What if he called the police and they came over and cuffed her and dragged her out of his house and discovered that, my goodness, my God, she really is Anne Frank. She's alive. He would be forever known as the person, the Jewish person, that reported Anne Frank to the authorities. Even if he could survive the shame, even if he could weather the ignominy of it all, he could never survive the look on Mother's face when she found out. He had a better chance of surviving the Holocaust itself. My own son, she would say, ratting out Anne Frank. You had to call the police, she would say. What's the matter? You didn't have Dr. Mengele's number? He doesn't make house calls? You want Elie Wiesel's address? Maybe you could turn him in, too. No, no, hell no. There would be no police, if that much Kugel was certain. He would find another way. The old lady would die soon from the looks of it. Maybe he could wait it out. But then what? Hello, police? There's a dead woman in my attic? Her name? Well, funny story. Kugel gently placed the phone back in its cradle and, sliding quietly from bed, knelt down beside the vent on the floor. He listened. Maybe he dreamt it. Maybe she'd gone. He pressed his ear against the vent. Mother moaning. The television laughing. And the typing from the attic. Ceaseless. Desperate. It dawned on Kugel as he knelt on the cold floor of his bedroom that the very thing he'd feared the past month and a half, a house fire, might, as it turned out, have been the best thing that could have possibly happened. Combing through the smoldering wreckage, the police would find the body of some old lady, but at least she would be gone, out of his hair, and the insurance would pay off handsomely. Bree shifted, turned on her side, and mumbled something in her sleep. She isn't going to like this, Kugel thought as he watched her. She isn't going to like this at all. He'd already allowed one crazy old lady into the house, his mother, and they were still waiting for her to die. A physician, said Professor Jove, is but a criminal dealer of the narcotic of hope. Kugel got to his feet and slid quietly back into bed. Kugel first began seeing Professor Jove the previous year, soon after Jonah's illness. Kugel was having a hard time sleeping. The anxiety and anger that had been building within him for some time were threatening to spill over, and he was determined to do whatever was necessary to be the husband Bree deserved and the father Jonah needed. He'd seen analysts in the past, but psychiatry was too narrow a scope for him now. Professor Jove, however, was a polymath. Not just a Jungian or a Freudian, not just a Kantian or a Cartesian. He had studied the ancients and the moderns, the realists and impressionists. He had studied everyone from Aristotle to Zarathustra, from Democritus to Heraclitus, and, as he liked to say, all the itises in between. He was, in a sense, the distillation of all Western and Eastern thought of the past 2,000 years combined, and it was Professor Jove's opinion, standing as only someone today could on the 21st century peak of all history, heir to all mankind's experience, wisdom, and knowledge, that the greatest source of misery in the world, the greatest cause of anguish and hatred and sadness and death, was neither disease, nor race, nor religion. It was hope. Hope? Kugel asked. Pessimists, Professor Jove replied, don't start wars. It was hope, according to Professor Jove, that was keeping Kugel up at night. It was hope that was making him angry. "Give up," read the sign on the wall behind Job's book-covered desk. "You'll live longer." "But you've been to Yale, Harvard, Cambridge," said Kugel. "That's how I know," said Professor Jove. Kugel had waited weeks for an appointment. "We are rational creatures," Professor Jove explained. "Hope is irrational. We thus set ourselves up for one dispiriting fall after the next. Anger and depression are not diseases or dysfunctions or anomalies. They are perfectly rational responses to the myriad avoidable disappointments that begin in a thoroughly irrational hope." Kugel wasn't sure he understood. Professor Jove smiled warmly. "Tell me," he said, "Hitler was the last century's greatest what?" Kugel had shrugged. "Monster?" "Optimist," said Professor Jove. "Hitler was the most unabashed, doe-eyed optimist of the last 100 years. That's why he was the biggest monster. Have you ever heard of anything as outrageously hopeful as the final solution? Not just that there could be a solution, to anything, mind you, while we have yet to cure the common cold, but a final one, no less. Full of hope, the Führer was, a dreamer, a romantic even, yes? If I just kill this one, gas that one, everything will be okay. I tell you this with absolute certainty. Every morning, Adolf Hitler woke up, made himself a cup of coffee, and asked himself how to make the world a better place. We all know his answer, but the answer isn't nearly as important as the question. The only thing more naively hopeful than the final solution is the ludicrous dictum to which it gave birth, never again. How many times since never again has it happened again? 3, 4, that we know of, mind you? Mao, optimist. Stalin, optimist. Pol Pot, optimist. Here's a good rule for life, Kugel. No matter where you happen to live or when you happen to be born, when someone rises up and promises that things are going to be better, run. Hide. Pessimists don't build gas chambers. "I just want my family to be safe," said Kugel. "I just want the world to leave us alone. Is that asking too much?" "What," asked Professor Jove, "did Jesus Christ say when they nailed him to the cross?" "I don't know," said Kugel. "What did Jesus Christ say when they nailed him to the cross?" "He said, ouch," said Professor Jove. "I don't get it," said Kugel. "There's nothing to get," said Professor Jove. "It hurt. First they whipped him half to death, then they held him down and nailed iron spikes through his wrists. If he was lucky, they did the same to his feet. The weight of his body bearing down on his chest made it difficult to breathe, and he died, slowly and agonizingly, from respiratory distress." "I still don't get it," said Kugel. "There is hurt in this world," said Professor Jove. "There is pain. Hoping there won't be only makes it worse." So he decides to not tell his wife and deal with it on his own. The next morning, his wife is hearing tapping sounds on the vent because Anne Frank is trying to signal him because she wants something. She's hungry. And just as he was hoping, there's that word again that she had gone and he'd dreamt it all. He goes back up to tell her to stop knocking on the vents. So he finds her behind the eaves again. In the sunlight, faint as it was, she was even more hideous than he'd gathered the night before. Her hair, wiry, unkempt, hung over her face. Her gnarled hands were capped with yellowed, talon-like fingernails. The floorboards behind the boxes, he noticed, were crisscrossed with long scratches and deep gouges, places where she had dragged herself back and forth by those very same fingernails. Her voice, when it came, was a low growl. "I'm out of matzah," she said. "Were you banging on the vents?" asked Kugel. "I'm out of matzah. Don't bang on the vents." "I'm out of matzah. I can't work without matzah." "Don't bang on the fucking vents." Kugel walked back to the western wall of boxes and examined her bed and workspace. His back to the old woman, he reached into his pocket and placed an apple on top of the remaining boxes. "How long have you been up here?" he said. "A while." "What's a while?" "A while. A week? 10 days? 30 years, she said. 30 years? Kugel returned to the eastern wall in time to see her scurrying, insect-like, along the floor and around the corner. "Or 40, she grumbled from the darkness, give or take. Kugel could hear through the heating return vent in the center of the attic floor the sounds of breakfast being cleared downstairs in the kitchen, of the kitchen sink running as Bree rinsed the dishes, of silverware clinking, of Jonah's feet as he stomped, squealing about the kitchen. Down there, thought Kugel, all was sunshine and beauty and life and possibility. And yet here he stood in this attic, in darkness and suffocating gloom, surrounded by misery and death. It was as if the cosmos had flipped, or perhaps we'd simply had it wrong all along. The rapture of heaven below, the agony of hell above. The streets of the afterlife, he thought, had better be clearly marked. "You'll be glad to know," Kugel said aloud, "that I've decided not to involve the police." She was moving behind the western wall now, her breathing labored as she shuffled about in the darkness. She stopped, and he saw her hand reach up, take the apple, and replace it, a moment later, with a folded piece of paper. "What's that?" he asked. "A shopping list," she said. Then again, he thought, maybe she really was insane. "Do you know why?" he continued, ignoring the list. "Why what? Why I'm not going to call the police." "Because you're German," she said, "and you feel guilty for committing atrocities." "I am not German," said Kugel. Just then she emerged from behind the boxes at the open end of the western wall, a black mass, lumpish and dust-covered and trailing spiderwebs from her back and hair. Kugel stepped back. When he was a small boy, he would cry from fright at the sight of the mentally handicapped, certain he was going to catch whatever it was they had. Slowly, with what seemed like great effort, the old woman brought up one foot beneath her, then the other, until she could push herself up to as upright a position as Kugel imagined she could attain. Perhaps she truly had spent the past 40 years in this attic, he thought, as she had seemingly come to resemble it. Her body had adapted or evolved or devolved into a shape most suitable for attic life. Her knees seemed permanently bent at just the right angle to keep her head from hitting the rafters, and her spine and hips inclined forward at very nearly the same degree of slope as that of the roof. She took a moment, winded from the hard work of achieving verticality, and then cocked her head sideways, fixing that hideous yellow eye of hers on Kugel's. She looked him up and down. "Because you're Jewish," she said, "and you feel guilty for not suffering atrocities." There was something familiar about her, Kugel thought. When he realized what it was, he wondered if perhaps he was mad, too. It was something about the shape of her eyes, the high hairline, the cheeks, the strong chin. Something, if you accounted for advanced age, decades of torment, multiple vitamin deficiencies, and a fair degree of decay. Something undeniably, disturbingly, and Frankish. Kugel backed away again as she passed him on her way to the overturned boxes in the middle of the floor. "What about the previous owners, the Messerschmitts?" he asked. "They knew you were up here?" She knelt beside one of the boxes, repeating in reverse order the same slow, laborious process by which she had just risen, and nodded. The Messerschmitts, she said, "were good people. Germans, mind you, but self-hating, the best kind. I prefer the self-hating. Self-hating Germans, self-hating Jews, self-hating French, self-hating Americans. We'd have far fewer problems in this world if more people had the courage to be self-hating." Kugel stood by the side of the dormer window that overlooked the front porch and driveway. He heard the front door close, and a moment later, Bree appeared in the driveway, carrying Jonah to the car. How small they looked from up here, how fragile, how vulnerable, how mortal, how unlikely to be, to continue to be. There was something nice about it, this hiding, this invisibility, this being in nothingness. He glanced over at the old woman kneeling on the floor and heaving his books and belongings back into the boxes. There was definitely something Anne Frankish about her. "I'm not calling the police," he said, "because you're going to leave on your own." "I certainly hope so," she replied. "Fantastic. I'll help you pack." "Great," she said, "as soon as I'm done with it." Bree had secured Jonah in his car seat and was climbing behind the wheel. It seemed like the height of irresponsibility, putting a child into a car, strapping him like a fighter pilot into a 3-ton box of steel and glass. Their car had airbags in the front and side. It had airbags, no doubt, everywhere the other car wouldn't strike it. He could line the perimeter of the damn thing with airbags. Doors, windows, beams, wheels, and a tree would fall on the roof, crushing them. Kugel had put safety locks on all the kitchen cabinet handles, foam bumpers on all the sharp corners, outlet covers on all the sockets. Maybe he should relax a bit. "As soon as you're done with what?" he asked her. "With my book." "Naturally," said Kugel. "Of course, because you're Anne Frank." "Because," she said, "I am a writer." "We should get a bigger car, a truck maybe. Everyone else has one. Yukons, Hummers, Tahoes." It was no longer a matter of keeping up with the Joneses. It was a matter of not getting crushed by them. "Been working on it long?" Kugel asked. 60 years, she said, give or take. "Well, lady," said Kugel, "you really get into a role, I'll give you that." He walked across the attic and looked out the window to the backyard. Mother was inside her vegetable garden. He watched as she pulled on a section of the fence for a few moments, then stopped, moved to the next section, and began pulling on that one. She never could seem to find the gate, and when she did, she pushed instead of pulled, and determined that the gate must be elsewhere. she would slowly work herself into a panic. "Hell of a show we're putting on down here," thought Kugel. "Don't forget to tip your creator." "So, Anne," he said as he watched Mother down below, "why does everyone think you died in Auschwitz?" "Bergen-Belsen." "Whatever." "It's a lot easier to stay alive in this world," said the old woman, "if everyone thinks you're dead." "Mm-hmm," said Kugel. Mother was at the gate now. If she pulled, she'd be out. If she pushed, she'd be out. She pulled and pulled again, wiped her brow, and moved on, as ever, from salvation to bondage. There were, of course, continued the old woman, a number of financial considerations. "Saul," Mother called out. "Saul, I'm stuck." "Financial considerations," said Kugel. "I was alone, Mr. Kugel. I was 18, hiding in the attic of an old farmhouse, somewhere between Belsen and Hanover. A man by the name of Franz something. I can't recall any longer. The self-loathing son of a former mid-level SS officer. Franz was hiding me, this sickly, terrified Jewish girl, from nothing, in his attic, even though the war had ended, hoping, I suppose, that the unimaginable sins of the father could be absolved by the second-rate good deeds of the son. Blew his head off 10 years later, the poor bastard did. The sins of the father shall be visited upon the sons. What an abominable idea, said Anne. Who said that? God, said Kugel, looking down at Mother struggling in her garden. One day, Anne continued, Franz came up to the attic carrying a newspaper in his hand. He held it out to me with tears in his eyes. Is this you? He asked. Thousands of people, it seemed, were reading my diary. I'd forgotten about it by then, to be honest. It was a couple of years later, and I was already at work on my first novel. Anyway, I convinced Franz to take me to the publisher in Amsterdam. It was the first time I'd been out of the attic since the war ended, and the first time I'd been in Amsterdam since the war began. With my heart in my throat, I knocked on the publisher's door. May I help you? He asked. I'm Anne Frank, I said. Mother began pulling on the gate again. And what did he say? Asked Kugel. After a moment, she replied. He said, fuck you. Kugel turned to her. She had finished packing up the boxes and was now pushing them with her back toward the wall. I was taken aback, she continued, as you can imagine, and so I repeated myself, assuming he'd misheard me. I'm Anne Frank, I said. Who isn't? He replied. As it turned out, there had been, ever since the diary was published, a steady stream of girls in to see this publisher, day in, day out, all claiming to be me, all wanting a piece of the royalties. I recalled as he told me this, seeing some other girls of my age in the waiting room outside his office, some tall, some short, some fat, some thin, all of them, though, wearing as downcast and maudlin a countenance as they could manage, much as they managed as they imagined the woeful little girl from the attic would. The editor naturally thought I was a fraud as well, but when I told him about the parts of the diary my father had edited out, parts only I, back then, could have known about, he saw that I was indeed who I claimed to be. And do you know what he said then? Fuck you, offered Kugel. She fixed her eye on him once more. He closed the office door, she said, sat me down in his chair, and said, stay dead. Having finished writing all the boxes, the old lady pulled herself back along the floor to the western wall and scurried behind it. When she was gone from view, Kugel went to the boxes and began lifting them one by one back into place. He said, Mr. Kugel, the anger in her voice beginning to rise, that nobody wants a live Anne Frank. They want a martyr. They want to know we've hit bottom, that it gets better because it can't get any worse. They want to know that we can rise like a phoenix from our own fiery human ashes. But tell me, Mr. Kugel, what is the point of a phoenix rising if all he ever does is gaze down with perverse longing at its own torched reliquiae? Stay down, you miserable bastard bird. Stay down. The glory was in rising, fool, not in having burned. We all burn. Everyone burns. Burning doesn't make you special. She was shadowing now, and Kugel stepped back from the wall. He went to his desk, Mr. Kugel, held up a copy of that goddamn diary with that goddamn smiling child on the goddamn cover, and said, they don't want you. They want her. Mother called out for him again. Saul, please, I'm frightened. Kugel took the shopping list in his hand, pressed it into his pocket, and headed for the stairs. I told him I was working on a novel, Anne Frank called out loudly after him. Do you know what Mr. Editor did then, Mr. Kugel? He laughed. Stay dead, he repeated. Stay dead. I'm a writer, Mr. Kugel. I am not a child. I am not some goddamn memoirist. I am a writer. 32 million copies, Mr. Kugel. That's nothing to sneeze at. I will leave this attic when I finish this book, and not one moment sooner. Not one moment sooner. I'm a writer, Mr. Kugel. Do you hear me? A writer. Kugel headed down the stairs. Matzah, Anne Frank shouted after him. Get me my matzah. Kugel folded the stairs and let the attic door close with a crash. He enjoyed the silence that followed. Mother called again. Saul, please, I'm frightened. "And Frank," Kugel muttered to himself as he headed outside to rescue Mother from her garden. "That's all I fucking need."
So if you are not speechless, now we will open it up to questions. Would somebody like to start us off? Maybe I'll start us off then. I wonder if you could each talk about the kernel of the idea that sort of spurred each of your books.
You go first.
All right. For me, it was the idea. I'd written a memoir, and I, you know, memoirs don't get a lot of critical respect, and my mother didn't love me, so I wanted some. And I decided I'd write a novel. And there's these rules, and one of the rules is that the character has to have a flaw, and I thought it'd be funny or interesting if the flaw that the character had was something we generally think of as positive. So not gambling or drinking, but being hopeful. And that's what screwed him all the time, and because in my life, that's what always got me. I'd have been happier if I were more hopeless. And so that was where it started. And once it was that, and it was like, okay, what's he hoping for? He's hoping for a good life, a good marriage, health for his son. And I'm just writing this down, and you never know what's going to come out, and hopes that he doesn't die in a gas chamber. And that just led to all of this. So it started out that way and became an 800-page book that I ditched for one page and started over again with one page and ditched that one. But just like the idea of a guy who finds his mother in his attic one day because she's always thinking a Holocaust is coming. And she does this fairly regularly, so it wasn't a surprise to him. But after another 100 pages or so, I remember just thinking, oh, for God's sake, it's Anne Frank.
And it's Anne Frank because?
Because she's in there. It just happened. And so it was kind of fun then, you know, putting the pieces together of how she might have got there and why it's the worst possible thing for him at this particular moment. And as a person who's full of hope, to have this symbol of suffering and death while he's trying to build a family. Mm. Ben?
I started my book thinking about what would be the worst thing I could take away from a character and what kind of story would result. And I thought that someone who had to leave his children willingly because it was unbearable to be around him, that was such an upsetting thought to me that I couldn't really stop thinking about it. And if I thought then that it was possibly the fault of the child unwittingly or it came through their language, I could tell a more interesting story. I've written a lot about language as a physical substance. I think about how powerful, how potent it is, how it's almost like a drug. It makes us feel things. And I wondered what it would be if we had too much of it. What if there was really just simply a quota of just how much we could bear before it started to undo us, to cripple us? So the story came together around that. The opening scene I wrote, I had a married couple leaving their child, and I really wasn't sure why, and I had to kind of build the why, and that's what came out.
Anyone like to follow up? Gentleman in the front row, if you'd wait for the mic, sir, on your right.
Mr. Auslander, I just finished Foreskin's Lament a few weeks ago, loved it, and does your personal anger at God have a place in your new book?
No, it's more my anger at humanity, I think. I always thought that once I dealt with God and got this sort of asshole-y God out of my life, just dealt with him somehow, then things would be swell. And then what you realize after that is nothing changes, and you've still got thousands of years of horrible history to answer for, and if there's no God, the only one to blame is us. And so it actually became quite a lot worse because there wasn't a force to point the finger at other than, wow, this is just the way we're wired. Aristotle said we're the species that laughs, and that's what differentiates us, but we're also the species that builds gas chambers. bears don't do that to salmon. They just kind of pluck them out. So that was kind of that. But I didn't realize that until halfway through the book, that there was that continuum going on.
All the way back on our left. Joe, if you could put your hand up.
Hi, this question is for Mr. Auslander. I read a story a long time ago. I think it was written by Philip Roth, but I'm not sure. But in the story, Anne Frank lives under a different identity, and she's trying to shake off her identity. But when she's outed, she tries killing herself by jumping off a roof. I was wondering if you're familiar with that story, and if you are, if that inspired you to use Anne Frank in the book that you just
Right.
wrote.
Well, I've said this before. I've been here before, and I think I've said this before. And we didn't do it this time, but maybe next time. First person to, at a reading that I'm at, mention Philip Roth, balloons fall down, and they get a $500 check. And it won't
yes,
take very long. But no, I haven't. I just never read him. I read part of Portnoy, and I loved Sabbath Theater, and then I think I just didn't want to be influenced in any way, and I just didn't want... It's a similar thing with, like, Salinger, where I can read him, but then I start writing like him, and I don't want to do that. And Elkin, there's just some people whose voices get in your head, and so I just never really went close to that. In fact, it wasn't until the book was already in galley form, and I had lunch with somebody from this sort of Jewish literary website, and she goes, oh, so is it... but this is actually Anne Frank, not like what Philip Roth did. And I was like, oh, you've got to be fucking kidding me. But I guess there are some people who just, you know, have very tall shadows that you're in, even if you don't know it. And that's probably the case with him. But no, I hadn't read it. Is he doing it? Is he writing anything about a transsexual? Okay. Because that's the next one. I just want to... You don't have any Roth transsexuals?
He has, yeah. That's coming out.
A Jewish transsexual in the Holocaust. Damn it! All the good ideas are taken.
Another couple of questions. I'm right in the front row here.
Simply, why the name Kugel? A pudding? A luxurious?
Yeah, it's a noodle pudding. I think writers do this. They just find things and they stick in their heads. For me, I saw it. Article years ago in the New York Times, and it was in the food section, called Unraveling Kugel. And I thought that was like a funny title, like Kugel Unravels, like some existential thing about a guy named Kugel. And so I needed a name for this, and I just came up with it. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they're like, well, you know, some of the names, like Solomon Kugel, and he's married to someone named Bree, and there's Professor Jove, which is like, God. Like, I don't usually like, you know, funny names in books, but you managed to pull it off. And I was like, he's like, why did you use it? And to be honest, I have a ridiculous name. And so I can't remember if I meet a Joe Smith or a Bob whatever. But if I meet, you know, Petunia Applegate, then I'll never forget him. And my name's kind of odd, and maybe that's just why I like odd names. But it wasn't done for comedy reasons. It was just because if I named them Steve Jones, I'd be constantly flipping back to see what their name was. And this way I could remember it pretty easily.
Right here, second row.
I'm looking forward to reading both of your books. And I'm intrigued by the theme of hope. Many years ago, I took the S training. And one of their themes was giving up hope. So I don't know if you can relate to that, but it does work.
It does.
It does.
I know.
It's personally
scary.
It does.
It's scary. And it wasn't like, I just thought it was a funny idea that hope might be a bad thing. But then, you know, you come up with characters who can argue that point very well, and the professor can argue it very well. And it's always fun to have someone say something horrifying that you can't really, kind of has a decent point. You just wish it weren't true. I remember I showed my shrink the book, and so naturally, because he's egotistical, he thought the character was based on him. But he did say that a large part of what mental health professionals do is try and get people to lose a little hope, just not raise the bar so high. He's not going to be good looking and a good husband.
It's not based on reality.
Right. The myths are never true. The myths are always, that's why we have them, because they're not true.
Does your teenage child in your mind, did that child have a younger life that you were thinking about? Or is the character just the age that you're writing about?
There's a point in the book when the narrator recounts the earlier birthday parties they threw for their daughter, and how the celebrations turned from kind of the mayhem of toddlers crushing cupcakes underfoot and babies drawing on the walls and bathrooms getting ruined to the kind of adolescent request for solitude, for privacy, for money. And so in the book, her journey from kind of intimacy to estrangement is tracked briefly.
Gentleman about eight rows back.
Ben, the excess of language and words. Tomorrow, I believe, Wikipedia and Google and a few others are going to go black for the day. Do you think we might all be better off if they went black 3 or 4 days a week in their weak, pathetic protest against pending legislation against people who actually create content?
Do you know how to do that? I mean, it'd be fun to try it. You know, we're surrounded by language used for very kind of utilitarian things. The first use of language was really just to keep track of who owed money to whom. In Sumeria, letters and codes developed so that we could track debt. And you know, to me, writing fiction is trying to do something with language that we don't do in public at all. So it's not about talking about where you went to dinner or reporting information or any of the very useful but sort of plain and superficial things we do all the time. And I do feel like I have to not pay a lot of attention in order to, I guess, look into other possibilities of language. I love reading novels because we don't talk to each other that way. We never really hear this kind of language. And if you surrender to it, you can enter these amazing places inside people's books. So does this rampant use of superficial language, is it bad for us? You know, obviously it's horrible. I don't, and maybe that's partly why I'm fantasizing about turning it off, but I don't know. I haven't actually figured out how to do it.
It's funny. When you write a book, you have to become a whore for a few months and sell it. And so people ask you to do things and you have to say yes. And one of the things I was asked to do is write a playlist that people should listen to while they're reading
the
book.
The soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do the John Cage 4 minutes and 33 seconds? Here it is.
No, you know what it is? And it's the truth. It's the only thing I have on my iPhone. I listen to white noise. I have a white noise on a constant loop, and you have to make sure you crossfade it so there's not that moment of noise in between. Yeah. But you can just block out everything.
Yeah.
There's also a great program called Freedom on computers that will shut off your internet for a set amount of time, and the only way to undo it is to actually shut down and restart. But it's interesting that it might be in the future that the most profitable technologies are the ones that undo all the ones that are now making a lot of money.
And there's a really great new app. It's a typewriter.
Oh, the old kind, the Underwood.
It's called a typewriter. It's an app, and you just put paper in it.
Yeah.
And it's new. It doesn't connect to the internet.
Yeah, but it's really hard to get. It's very hard to get paper.
It's hard, but it's just. That's where they get you. It's really heavy.
It's 99 cents a sheet.
Yeah, you can't download it.
No.
And so we've come to the end. Shalom Auslander, Ben Marcus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.